The business press in this country failed to do its job in the run-up to the economic meltdown of 2008. Business reporters blew it, and there's no question about it. So says Dean Starkman. He's author of The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism. The result was an uninformed public that was left powerless about the complex problems that overtook the banking system. Dean Starkman is an editor of the Wall Street, of the Columbia Journalism Review. He's a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And Dean, so good to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Nice to be with you, Steve.
Well, is there any question from that the financial media blew it here? Because you say it point blank in this book, the watchdog didn't bark.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question in my mind. And, you know, I speak with some authority, I think.
Yeah.
We did a pretty thorough review at the Columbia Journalism
Review. For the magazine, right?
Yeah, in 2009 that read basically 7.5 years of business news coverage from 9 publications and looking for things that you could legitimately describe as warning stories. And really, it was so disappointing in many ways to discover that while there were some interesting things done and actually some excellent work done in the early part of that period up to 2003.
I was going to say, in the early part of the decade, there was some stuff.
Yeah, and for reasons I try to explore, the whole energy and the enterprise and the ambition of business news completely almost peters out completely between 2004 through 2006, which are really the insane years of mortgage mania and Wall Street's frenzy.
Well, and I guess the big question then is, what happened? How could that possibly have occurred at a time when business journalism all over the TV screens, Wall Street Journal?
Right.
How could it have happened?
Great question. I mean, you're right. You see CNBC, and it's on 24/7, or feels like it is wall-to-wall coverage of this beat that's supposed to be so central to its mission. And the Wall Street Journal has the word Wall Street in its very name. You know, I ascribe the failure, and I think I really do demonstrate the failure. But I ascribe the failure to 3 basic functions. One is not the press's fault. One is this was a period of fairly radical deregulation by the Bush administration. It's not really a political statement. It's just there was an explicit goal of that administration, and that really affects investigative journalism because effective regulation and journalism, as a former print guy, they really play off each other, and one sort of reverberates with the other.
So what you're saying is that when the government is removed from the equation, a lot of sources that reporters could have suddenly are sort of in the dark too.
Sources, documentation, white papers, grand juries, indictments, you name it, complaints, civil complaints, regulatory, that and also regulators actually also, when they're effective, pick up many of their cases from the press. So there's this kind of interesting and very healthy dynamic that goes on between those two. So that's one piece.
The second one is the CNBCization of the media. I love that phrase.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's a cultural problem. Mm-hmm. It's a cultural problem. And CNBC, basically it's a symbol. It's a news organization. It's also a symbol of a style of journalism. And in that style, it emphasizes 2 things, essentially speed and getting access to powerful people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, both of those things are not going to be friendly to investigative journalism, period, full stop. I mean, if you're in a hurry to crank out the latest earnings report, you're just not going to go particularly deep into what the bank is doing outside of the 4 corners of its financial results.
Yeah.
And secondly, if you're spending all of your time, and that's what they do all day, every day, trying to get access to Jamie Dimon or Vikram Pandit at Citigroup or back in the day, Jimmy Kane at Bear Stearns or Dick Fuld at Lehman Brothers, that's not where the story was.
Yeah. And there's a sense, too, as you talk about that part of it, the CNBCization of the media, that their focus of the media at that point is on consumers and giving consumers tips about the market and sort of a whole different vantage point than one that would lend itself to really digging into what's going on Wall Street.
Yeah, completely different perspective. I mean, I trace – my book has 4 histories of – 4 chapters of history, people might wonder why, but basically, business news was created essentially as an intra-market messaging system for investors, about investment, And if you were and CNBC really carries that DNA, and actually the rest of the business press does too, to this very day. But if you're going to be looking at banks strictly from an investor's point of view, I mean, you're going to get a completely upside down picture. For one thing, during 2004 through 2006, these were the most prosperous times probably in the history of banking. Citigroup's 2005 earnings were something on the order of $25 billion. This is net income. Mm-hmm. After dividends, after executives' bonuses, after buybacks, after everything. That's the net left over. That's one of the largest profits in the history of public companies, period, full stop. Only Exxon made more slightly a little bit later. So when you're looking at that bank, which was one of the worst actors, right, of the pre-crash era, if you're looking at it from an investor's perspective, looks great. Looks fantastic, in fact. But what you didn't see was what reporters who were mostly in the alternative press were seeing was what was actually happening on the ground, mm-hmm. and what was behind those earnings.
Yeah.
And basically what was behind those earnings were mortgages and the mortgage products that were turned into securities and then derivatives. So you have to kind of like start from the bottom up and see, okay, how are these mortgages being made? Mm-hmm. What are the terms of these transactions? And then could you see that there was serious problems in just basically the basic functioning of these banks.
You know, we'll talk a little bit later about maybe one of the heroes that shows up in this book, a guy who did some real, groundbreaking work talking to people who were taking out mortgages and getting a real sense of the story from the ground up.
Right.
His name is Mike Hudson. We'll get to him in a bit. The third factor you point to here, Dean, before I get away from it too far, I guess is just basically the downsizing of the journalism industry. It's been happening for years. I've been living it.
Right.
I know what that's all about.
Right. It's the third leg of this argument, and if you were working in newspapers during this period, you can sort of feel it viscerally. So as most of your listeners know, I mean, newspapers have been undergoing a crisis for basically the better part of a decade, which unfortunately coincided with the mortgage era.
Yeah.
Essentially,
yeah.
Started with the tech wreck, 2000-2001, that created a big problem, bigger overlooked problem of big ad recession in the newspaper business, and there was a bit of a crisis there. And then, of course, the internet began to sort of take hold, and first Google and Facebook, Craigslist began to drain the business underpinning of news organizations. That led to not just downsizing; it also led to this sort of a crisis of confidence in the newsroom and a risk aversion that I think really affected how people decided to cover the news.
It's also a sense, too, just being blunt about it. When you talk about this story, it's just complicated enough. And you start dropping words like derivatives,
right.
And you're going to, check out a whole lot of readers out there who don't know what that is, don't really care, and aren't going to want to spend time reading long articles that deal with stuff like that.
Yeah, and that's sort of the tragedy of this particular story, because it comes in two pieces. One is, of course, there's the mortgage market, and the other is what I call the mortgage aftermarket, what was done to the mortgages on Wall Street and elsewhere. And okay, I grant that the second piece was complicated, but really, when you sort of think about it, all of that stuff that blew up, everything that was on the books of German pension funds and Lehman Brothers and your local school board, all of that basically was made, the raw material that was mortgages. And no one can tell me that was a complicated story.
It's funny. It's really not that complicated.
Really.
Once you sort of get past the 10-yard line, you can sort of figure it out.
Look, in business news, unfortunately, there's a sense that they kind of like it when people are intimidated by big concepts.
Yes.
Reporters like to be the high priest that people need to consult to understand what's going on Wall Street. The maddening thing really about, and this is what I think if listeners take away anything, is that in the end, this crisis was not especially complicated. The mortgages were defective, period, full stop. And that was the basis for all the other junk that we saw that caused the global financial crisis. And that's sort of the tragedy from a journalism point of view of this whole story, because if all you had to do I mean, it's easy for me to say in retrospect, but let's say it in retrospect. Yeah. All one had to do, as some people did do, was follow the money. You saw all the problems flooding, first inner cities and then mortgages in general around the country in those era. And what you needed to do was trace the mortgages back to their funding source.
Yeah.
Funding source is Wall Street. Wall Street were the lenders, the underpinning of the entire subprime industry from Countrywide to IndyMac and all the other ones you've heard of. And they're the ones that both gave them the loans to make those loans and then bought the loans back and made them into these defective products. Mm. So really in the end, of course, mortgage-backed security sounds sort of intimidating. A derivative, a collateralized debt obligation is basically get into the details, but basically it's just a repackaging of the same stuff.
And reselling it.
Period, full stop. And that's sort of the thing. So don't let anybody kid you that this was sort of unknowable or unfathomable and no one could understand it. It really wasn't.
Dean Starkman's our guest. He's the author of a new book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism. I want you to know that he'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Central Library, the branch downtown, 14 West 10th Street in downtown Kansas City. More information about his talk and to grab a seat, just go to kclibrary.org. You know, it's interesting to me, as you went through the history of journalism and business in this book, that this notion that the media missed this story, this isn't the first time the media has been caught flat-footed. You also point out that the media sort of missed the 1929 crash. The big papers dismissed the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s.
Right.
There's sort of some dark history here that goes beyond the more recent stuff.
It's so interesting, to kind of – I've been a journalist as you have for basically – we're about the same age.
Too long.
And you sort of see that styles of journalism and the quality of journalism does ebb and flow over time.
Yeah.
And I call the book The Watchdog That Didn't Bark because the title sort of presupposes there is such a thing as a watchdog, right? And I firmly believe that there is such a thing. And I actually wrote this book in order to do two things. One, to establish that, in fact, journalism is actually quite powerful, quite a powerful force in the public interest when it puts its mind to it.
Yeah.
And of course it can fail. And that's what I'm arguing happened during the mortgage era. So, there are problems when what I call accountability reporting kind of loses its support, mm-hmm. basically within newsrooms, within news ownership. That's when the trouble starts. And that's sort of what I'm arguing that the public sort of needs to look out for. I mean, of course, there's lots of news, but, you have to start to distinguish between what's really valuable and what's, what's just okay. And this thread of reporting over the years that has been really effective can be sort of put into this category of accountability reporting. And when that works, it really does play an important role in protecting the public interest. And when it fails, we all pay for it.
Your questions about the business media and did it do its job or not, 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888. Dean, I'm just wondering about, one thing. I mean, how reasonable was it to expect that journalists could have peered into their crystal balls and foretold something, as invisible on one level as the subprime lending crisis? I mean, I cover politics for a living. I thought Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill was toast a couple of years ago when she was running for re-election. And then all of a sudden her opponent talks about legitimate race. The entire race turns upside down and things look very differently. So how reasonable was it to expect that the media could have done its job here?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you frame the question. But if you're going to argue that there's no way that we could have – why are we being faulted for failing to predict something that will happen in the future? And I'd say that's not the argument. The argument is actually failing to report on what's actually happening now, which mm-hmm. is your job. And if if it was all about what was happening on balance sheets of complex financial institutions, that's one thing. Sure, that's going to be complicated, although, again, some people were able to get to it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't about that. It was about what community activists and state regulators and state banking commissioners and plaintiffs' lawyers and borrowers were jumping up and down about, trying to get the press's attention. And only a few people did pay attention.
People were shouting, you're saying, no question about it.
But of course. And you know, there was an enormous amounts of activism and activity about mortgage lending problems starting, you know, really starting in the late 90s and reaching a crescendo up in 2003 when, you know, state legislatures and city councils around the country were all passing anti-predatory lending laws because of the dramatic rise in this problem. You know, Cleveland, Newark, Oakland, Chicago. I can't remember if Kansas City or Missouri passed legislation like that, but I'm quite sure that they did. I know St. Louis became a big center of foreclosures, but in fact, it was all about, really in the end, Steve, it was about who you were talking to as a reporter. Mm. You know, are you talking to Wall Street analysts, Wall Street executives, and people who sort of work in that milieu? If so, you're not going to get this story. If you're talking to a wider group of people, widen your gaze. I'm not saying not talk to them. I'm just saying broaden the picture a little bit. Pull the camera back and start to talk to people who are not at elite levels, but are actually working on the ground. And, mm-hmm. and you will invariably get your story.
A whole different thing. Let's go to some phone calls here for Dean Starkman. Matt from Baldwin City. Matt, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. This is an interesting discussion.
Great.
When the guest a few moments ago was talking about the kinds of defective products that were sold as investments, they were essentially incomprehensible algorithms. And this is interesting because so is the Bitcoin. And does the guest see a correlation between possibly an evolution between those kind of incomprehensible algorithms to these and where would that head toward?
What a great question. I hadn't really thought about it, but I'll bend my mind around this around the subject. Yeah, I mean, what was interesting about the algorithm, the Gaussian cupola, I guess it was called, that underpinned the mortgage derivatives, and then the Bitcoin thing is that essentially people use their authority, their education, and their credentials to vouch for this algorithm, which was, of course, beyond the understanding of most people. And basically in the mortgage case, I mean, that algorithm was sold to both actually Wall Street executives and the public itself as the thing that was almost virtually guaranteeing that we couldn't have a major crisis with these products. And, of course, the algorithm turned out to be faulty. Mm-hmm. And it was never actually meant to be deployed in that particular way in the first place. It was always had a very limited use. Same thing, yes, certainly could be said of the Bitcoin thing. If you don't, I mean, you know, really, in the end, if you're buying a collateralized debt obligation or Bitcoins, if you don't understand what's underlying it, probably the best idea is to stay away from it.
Huh. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You know, there was one guy, Dean, who didn't miss this story. I mentioned him earlier. His name was Mike Hudson. Tell us about Mike Hudson.
Yeah, interesting guy.
Yes.
Mike was, again, a reporter of a certain age at this point, but he was working at the Roanoke Times in the late 80s and in poorer neighborhoods of Roanoke, he noticed that a lot of people were entering these contracts to take out loans on their property without having any idea who they were buying it from and what they were buying. It turns out that was the nascent, the beginnings of what we would later call the subprime mortgage industry.
Yeah.
What was so interesting about it was when Mike was starting this his reporting, you know, it was really just a marginal business. Kind of, you know, the analogy would be to like payday lending or pawnbrokers. I mean, this was a small fraction, you know, of marginal both economically, marginal ethically. And what Mike saw in over the course of literally the next decade and a half was this this really tough racket. Mm-hmm. With very dubious history and very unethical, which known to deploy a pretty unethical sales practice.
And speaking of that, tell us about the guy that sort of he gets hooked on the story, a man who bought one of these mortgages, John Brown. Who is John Brown?
Yeah, I mean, John Brown is you know, sort of like emblematic of the whole
problem.
Yeah, John Brown was a man in his 40s who was still living with his mother and was found by a court to be developmentally disabled. And somehow he found himself signing a subprime mortgage and signing away his home, and he had a good deal.
He made basically got a worse deal by signing the thing over.
Yeah, and the tragedy in this case, of course, he could literally barely write his own name. It took several minutes for him to trace. He basically had to copy the letters from something that somebody had written for him, and you know that's sort of like. It was an extreme case, but it sort of summed up. And
yes.
He had a mortgage with Citigroup. He was from rural Georgia, and it sort of summed up sort of what we were looking at in this process, where it really didn't matter, who you were, whether or not you had a nickel to pay this back, and whether or not this would cost you your home. All incentives in the mortgage business, and all the way up through. All the way up through the Wall Street machine, was to get as many people into as many loans as possible at the highest rate as possible, and that was sort of the tragedy of this crisis.
Let me go to Bud from Overland Park. Bud, you're on with Dean Starkman. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Go quickly, Bud.
I want to point out real quick. I appreciate what you're doing, and I agree with you. However, the mortgage. Problem, the securitization, is not the only thing that happened, and I want to hesitate. Credit default swaps were a big part of this. We've completely ignored them, as far as I know, this whole hour, or the whole half hour, and I just want to point out that credit default swaps, the conservative legislators had us believing that the mortgages that the liberals were leaning on the Fannie Mae and so forth to make more mortgages, and that's what caused it. And unfortunately, that's the impression that I get from today here.
But let me just get a reaction from our guest. Credit default swaps are what exactly?
It's a great point. A credit default swap is basically an insurance policy that one institution takes out on a security. So what happened was essentially people thought started to get nervous about the housing market in 2006, 2005, 2006. And they created this CDS, a credit default swap, to take out insurance policy on these products. And, you know, there wasn't enough money to cover all the losses. And, it did make a huge contribution to the problem.
Dean Starkman is the author of The Watchdog That Didn't Bark. He'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the downtown Kansas City Public Library, 14 West 10th Street. Go to kclibrary.org for more information. You're great, Dean.